all members of the ANC to join the meeting because they constitute a bigger number of the committee.
So I'm on it, Chair. Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
Sure.
Chair, it's Alan. We are six. Mr. Morolong just joined.
Okay, Chair. I'll just get this thing right. Good morning, honorable members. You're welcome. Let me also welcome the FIC team, which is here, coming to make a presentation. PBO, welcome the team that support SCOF. Secretariat, researchers, and all the members of SCOF from the admin side, other parliamentary officials who are present here, media, you are all welcome. Today we are going to receive a report from the Financial Intelligence Center on the Financial Action Task Force Mutual Evaluation Report. It's a long-awaited report. Thanks very much for the team having worked around the clock to produce this report. The meeting is officially open. Are there apologies?
No apologies, Chair.
There are no apologies. Okay, let's move to item two, briefing by the FIC. I see Momo here is popping up. I was not aware that Treasury is in attendance. Momo and the entire executive management from Treasury, you are all welcome. And if ever there are other officials from other entities, they are also welcome. Thanks very much. Let me hand over. I'm not sure who's leading the team in terms of presenting the report. Who's leading the team, Alex?
If I may come in, Chair.
Okay. Yeah, Comrade Mom.
Yeah, no, Chair, we're doing this jointly, Treasury and the FIC. So, Corisile Kanire, the director. So, she and I will kind of lead on the presentation. This whole part of things is a big thing for government. So, Treasury is obviously the leading department.
Recording in progress.
So the two of us will lead the
recording
team.
Stopped.
Okay. No, you can proceed or Advocate Kanyile can take over. Whosoever.
Recording in progress.
Over to you now.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I don't know if the presentation is up. And honorable members, good morning. Noche, and thank you for this hearing. I mean, I think this hearing is really, really important for us as a country, because there certainly are big issues. And I'm really pleased that the committee is having a hearing today. Time is not on our side, I think, as you'll see when we've done the presentation. Chair, the presentation is quite technical at some points, but we've tried to make it hopefully comprehensible. I don't know. Ellen, is the presentation up?
Sorry, Mama, I've made a Peter Albert's co-host.
Okay.
I'm not sure if he's going to run it or should I do it from my side?
I don't know who, but if it can just come up. Thank you, Chair. So, Chair, this is a joint, and honorable members, this is a joint presentation by the advocate and myself. If you go on to the next slide, and we've got the team that's been working on it. You'll see on the FIC, which has been doing a lot of the hard work, Advocate Tanile and some of her key staff, Peter Smith, Phineas Maloto, Christopher Milan. I think they've all played key roles during the mutual evaluation process. And from the Treasury, us from the financial sector policy, Vukile, Errol, and Gordy. Next slide, please. So, Chair, just by way of background, countries go through what's called a peer review. And in fact, in the financial sector, as you may recall, you know, we have the so-called FSEPs that the IMF and World Bank do. And then there's a peer review by the Financial Stability Board. Similarly, you know, the Reserve Bank or the Prudential Authority will have the Basel Committee also conducting its own reviews. And these reviews generally in the financial sector, because it's so globally connected, other countries want to know, are we implementing the standards that are agreed to by us as a country? If they find that we're not enforcing the standards, if they find that our regulators are not checking and checking intensively and very strictly, then it sort of sets off concerns and remedial actions to be taken. And Chair, this is important because it means that they want to be able to trust that if one of our banks deals with their banks, say, in the United States, where we need the dollar trade, there's lots of correspondent banking. They want to check that our regulators are enforcing anti-money laundering and terrorist financing standards. And if we are not doing it, they will either not deal with us or there'll be a huge cost in just the way they deal with us. So South Africa, as you know, is a member of FATF, and we're the only member from our continent of Africa. The others do have some form of regional membership, but not direct membership. So in terms of this mutual evaluation, it's done in terms of FATF standards, which we'll explain in a moment. And I want the advocate just to come in because they played a role in hosting them. And the process had started in April 2019. And she can tell you a bit about how COVID came in a way and actually delayed this process to be actually much longer than it normally is. I don't know, Advocate, if you want to come in. Advocate Khalil, are you there? Okay, let let me proceed.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. And thank you for inviting me and as Momo has said, this is a joint presentation because this matter is far much bigger than the FIC. It involves the entire country, and it's very, very critical that we all combine our efforts in ensuring that we change the future that you are going to be leading to you, resulting from the assessment that has been done by the FATA. FATAC is an intergovernmental organization that sets standards when it comes to combating or curbing money laundering and the financing of terrorist financing. We, as Norman has indicated, that we assessed in 2019, it wasn't the first time that we assessed. We assessed before we even became a member, to ascertain whether we are fit and proper to even become a member. Once we passed that test, we assessed again in 2009, and there was a follow-up assessment in 2019. And you'll see from the results that we'll be presenting to you that the situation still looks very, very bad, and we need to work very, very hard to ensure that there's a plan to address our deficiencies so that we can be trusted globally, that we have a system that is agile enough to combat money laundering, terrorist financing, and any predicate offense or any proceeds generating crimes. And over to you, Mo.
Thank you, Director. So, Chair, maybe, and just to add on to what the Director has said, I mean, you will see during the presentation that what we have to say really affects many, many departments, particularly those in the criminal justice system, but also departments like DTI, social development, and so on. Because everyone's responsible for various pieces of legislation. And that's why, Chair, when we go to FATA, the Director and Advocate Peter Smith, and when it was non-COVID, myself and some of our team, Errol Makuvela and Goni Banyani, we would go to the FATA meetings. They have 3 plenary meetings a year to represent South Africa. And so next slide, please. And I should add that we also get, you know, many other departments coming to those meetings who kind of go into many of the smaller meetings around. So the plenaries are big affairs 3 times a year. So, Chair, just in terms of the FATA standards and I think our colleagues from FIC are very passionate about this, but I thought that let me explain it, because if I can understand it, maybe it will be easier to explain it to members, because I have to say to our colleagues, try and keep it in a form that I think is understandable, because honestly, it gets very technical, and even us in the Treasury, we would also struggle with some of the terminology and so on if you don't deal with this every day. So, Chair, FATA has 40 standards, or what it calls recommendations, which forms the basis of the mutual evaluation or the peer review. And member countries, and Peter can correct me or the Director, there's about, I think, 29 or 33 members, if I remember when last I counted. And as I said, South Africa is one of those. And
89. How
many members are there? So, Chair, so the members are expected to implement these standards. And over and above the member countries, Chair, you have regional bodies which also come in. So you'll find on our continent, there's 3 regional bodies, 3 or 4, and
each of those regional bodies, like we belong to Isamalek, which is most of Southern Africa and a bit of Central Africa. And those countries also then have to oversee the other countries or peer review them as well. So it really extends to every country. And no country wants to be left out. If it's linked to the global economy, they need dollar trading or renminbi or any other major currency. So the purpose of the mutual evaluation is to enable countries to make continuous improvements to their anti-money laundering and combating of financial terrorism. So chair and members, when you will see a lot of AML/CFT, anti-money laundering, and CFT is combating financing of terrorism. And there's also an element, by the way, of nuclear procurement hidden somewhere in this in these terminologies. So it's to address these and to do it through an independent peer review done by other countries and members of the FATF. And also you have members like IMF and so on getting involved. Next slide, please. So the 40 recommendations describe what is required by countries to have an anti-money laundering and CFT framework. And then there's also a technical compliance on effectiveness. They do a technical compliance, which looks at the country's laws and frameworks. And it really judges us. It has four categories, whether we are compliant with each of those recommendations, largely compliant, partially compliant, and non-compliant. Now, Chair, I'll deal with this later. It's not good to be partially compliant or non-compliant because those things trigger off all sorts of processes that put us on a list to get things corrected. Next slide. So over and above the 40 recommendations, FATF has 11 what it calls immediate outcomes to measure effectiveness. Now, this wasn't there when we had done our previous mutual evaluation, I think in 2010. This is, by the way, our third evaluation. And when we did the 2010 one, we were not at that stage judged by these measures on effectiveness. And if you look at the effectiveness, they also have four categories, whether it's high, substantial, moderate, or low. So if it's moderate, it says that the intermediate outcome is achieved to some extent. But here's the key point. Major improvements are needed. So actually, if we kind of get moderate on any of these immediate outcomes, it actually means we've kind of failed the test, that we've got below 33% in a manner of speaking. And we have to be both substantial and high in most of these. Next slide.
Hello, Momo, before you proceed, once you are there, I just want you to indicate that when we assessed in 2009, we had a lot of shortcomings when it comes to our laws. But most of the countries, especially countries that are members of the FATF, they are no longer now addressing issues of technical compliance, issues of whether they've got the right laws. They are now addressing the issues of those laws and ensuring that they are effective because they are implementing the laws correctly. We are looking very, very bad because when it comes to the 40 recommendations, you see that half of them were still really not looking good, about 20. So we've got a lot of work to do because even our laws have a lot of deficiencies. So we need to be closing the gaps when it comes to our laws so that we can be able to focus on the things that would seem to be bad fitness. It can take us more than 20 years really to address the laws. We assessed in 2009, our laws still had deficiencies. We assessed again in 2019, our laws are still having deficiencies. So this is a matter that we need to address and address now. Thanks,
Director, when you speak the next time, because you're all in a room, I think if we can speak into wherever the mic is directly, because I think members may be, I'm certainly struggling to hear you. So I think if we speak in the, I don't know where your mic is, I think it would help. But let's come to that. So the next slide, as the director said, anyway, Chair and honorable members, so we've been assessed on the immediate outcomes. We get moderate on 8 of them and low on 3 of them. So that's pretty bad. It's like saying we've failed the entire test on all 11 points. And then when it comes to the 40 recommendations, you'll find that, again, in many, you know, most of them are largely compliant. There's minor shortcomings. And many, 15 of them are partially compliant. So there's moderate shortcomings. When Fatah says moderate, it means pretty, it's not a good sign. And we're only compliant on 3 and non-compliant on 5. So you can see that, and I should add that these recommendations are the easy bit, because you can change it by just changing our laws and getting the system in place. But where we really, so this is, I think, will be doable for us. And perhaps in South Africa, we're good at doing that, or we'll succeed in that. But when it comes to effectiveness, that's where we have the biggest challenges. Next slide. So I'm going to ask the director and her team, because they are experts in looking at these recommendations. And I don't know if members can see the slide. It's a small slide, but I think it's an important slide, because it tells you where we are partially compliant. They've got the 40 standards. And if you look at the first one, we partially complied in the first recommendation and so on. But let them explain it. Director, I don't know who's coming on your side.
It will be Peter Smith here.
Yeah, and the sound is much better now, Director.
Yeah, thanks, Mama. We're much closer to the computer that we're using for the link. Good morning, Mr. Chair and honorable members and colleagues. I'm not going to walk through this whole slide, but I think the key message here, if one looks at all the red on the slide, those are all the areas where in the Mitch evaluation outcome, we were found to have fallen short of what the expectations are. Those are those partially compliant and largely, and non-compliant ratings. So I'll just pick out a few here that are important to understand what it is that FATF was looking for in the assessment. What is it that we're expected to accomplish in implementing the standards, and what is it then where we fell short? It starts off with the first two. The foundation of a money laundering system that works is to understand where the weaknesses are, where the points of attack may be, where people might want to abuse the financial system in your country. And when you have that picture of what the risks are for your country, then to adjust your policies and your laws and your implementation in accordance, so that you then deal with where the problem areas. You don't just take a blind blanket approach and try to put out fires whenever they arise. So it's meant to be used as a proactive planning mechanism to make sure your money laundering system, your counter-terror financing system, is targeted at the areas where you need to have the most effect. So that's what the first two recommendations are. And clearly, our system, the criticism is not that we don't have a system, but that our system is not risk-based, it's not targeted. It does not deal with the key vulnerabilities where people might want to abuse our financial system. Then there are quite a few criticisms that deal with shortcomings in our legislation. I think it's also important to understand that the FATF standards keep on evolving. So your legislation needs to keep pace with the standards as and when they are adapted or changed in in response to new developments. So, for instance, on customer due diligence, our laws were amended not too long ago, in 2017, the last time. That was the Financial Intelligence Center Act. But in the same time, the FATF has also continued evolving its standards, and there were then again shortcomings that we need to pick up and address through those amendments. Similarly, with our legislation against terror financing, that legislation was never really tested in court, and when FATF analysed the legislation, they pointed out a few matters that need to be addressed in amendments. A very important aspect of our system, which requires very, very urgent, significant attention, is on the beneficial ownership of companies. People that use companies or set up trusts and work from behind those companies and trusts to do business with our financial system, but without the bank or the financial institution really knowing who is behind the company. Those are recommendations 23 and 24, they're sort of on that right-hand column, where again we were partially compliant. Here we need fundamental amendments to legislation, for instance, in the legislation that regulates trusts, the way that trusts are set up, the responsibilities that are placed on trustees to know who they are interacting with, who their beneficiaries are, where the property comes from. Similarly, with companies, we need significant amendments in our company's legislation to provide for the company itself to know who owns the company, who sits behind the structure of that controls the company, and also for that information to be captured and be made available in some form of a database or a register that is administered from the public sector side, for instance, in the CIPC. We don't have any of these aspects in place in our law currently, and that requires significant attention. Some of the other elements that I'll just pick out here, new technologies have developed. We have things like crypto assets, Bitcoin, and Bitcoin even is now old news. There are new things that are developing every week on this front. And again, our legislation has not kept track of this. We don't have a framework to regulate the service providers that allow people to buy or sell these crypto assets, who place their South African rand or even dollars or euros in these assets and then transfer them. Once they are contained in a Bitcoin wallet or in a Ethereum wallet or something like that, the money can be extracted anywhere in the world, so mostly anonymously as well. So again, that's an area where our law needs to catch up and address the risks. We can move to the next slide. So I'll just quickly touch on this because I think Moma and the director has already covered this. This is the ratings on sort of a summary of the ratings on the effectiveness outcomes. So those 11 IOs that the members will see on the left-hand column, those are the immediate outcomes. Those are the things that the FATF expects one to achieve if your money laundering system works well. And they use that as the benchmark to see where how far off a country is in the implementation of their system. The first one, again, starts with the issue of understanding your risk and being able to mitigate the risk in your system by deploying your resources correctly, having the right policies in place, making sure that you target the right types of criminal activities in your investigations and so on. So that was the immediate outcome one, where we were rated moderate. The next one then moves into the international dimension. FATF also takes a view that each country in the global effort against money laundering should play its part and should be available to provide international cooperation, but also should seek international cooperation when it follows the criminal proceeds or terrorist financing crossing borders. The criticism here in our case was not so much that we don't provide effective international cooperation. In fact, I've had a few comments that sometimes the cooperation we provide is slow. We need a better system to administer cooperation requests in our Justice Department. But the key criticism actually here was that South Africa does not seek international cooperation often enough. We seem to chase the criminal up to the border or the money when it leaves the country, but then we don't make an effort to follow the money and reach out to our counterparts elsewhere in the world to follow the trail or to find the criminal. So that's mainly the reason why we were rated moderate again there. Supervision deals with how well our institutions are supervised, how well institutions such as the Prudential Authority, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the FIC, the State Agency, or it's now the Property Practitioners Regulatory Authority, the gambling boards, and so on. How well they check up on institutions and make sure that they comply with what the law requires of them. And we were rated again moderate here, mainly for the reason that outside of the financial sector, there is very little in place as far as supervision is concerned. We have almost nothing to demonstrate that institutions have been inspected to check that they comply with their obligations. And even if they were, there were really no consequences if they did not comply with the obligations that they have to meet. Now, the flip side of that is the outcome on preventative measures. This then looks at how effective are the institutions in the private sector at complying with the law, how well do they know their customers, how well do they report transactions to the FIC, are they on the lookout for people trying to exploit their services or their products. And if the supervision isn't up to standard, then one can immediately see that there's going to be a problem in the private sector as well. So that's a mirror image of the weaknesses in the supervision side. As I said, one of our very serious shortcomings is on the beneficial ownership. Who sits behind companies? Who sits behind trusts? Who abuses these company and trust structures when they don't want to be seen by our financial institutions, but they want to engage in our financial system? There we were rated low, mainly for the reasons that I touched on already, that our laws are not in place, but we also have no effective system for our law enforcement authorities to trace these beneficial owners of companies, trusts, and so on. Financial intelligence, that's mainly the work that starts off with the FIC producing intelligence that we need to pass on to law enforcement agencies. Law enforcement agencies need to investigate the criminal activity using the information that they receive as a lead to guide the investigation, and eventually need to bring that to a conclusion in a prosecution that can be done in the prosecuting authorities. The criticism here was that the financial intelligence that is produced is not often taken up and used in investigations. If it is, the investigations do not really take the cue from the intelligence to find the money laundering. The investigation then is more often in respect of the underlying criminal activity that generates the proceeds, not the laundering of the proceeds or the financing of the terrorism. And again, if one has problems in this area where financial intelligence is not adequately used, then one is also going to have problems in the next two categories on the investigations, prosecutions, confiscations of both money laundering and terrorist financing. So one can see the same ratings flow through on those. On the confiscation side, the main criticism was that we are not really looking at confiscating money, funds, criminal assets that cross the border, either come into South Africa from elsewhere in the world to be laundered here in the system, or that is taken out of South Africa to be laundered elsewhere in the world where the proceeds are generated here in the country. The general system that we have in the asset forfeiture unit to confiscate criminal assets received quite good comments in the report and is actually working very well. But this element of the cross-border confiscations is lacking in our system, and that led to the rating being a moderate. Terrorist financing, we came in for some serious criticism in the sense that South Africa is focused on combating terrorism, but does not use the financing aspect of terrorism to necessarily understand how terrorist organizations elsewhere in the world operate, And whether or not they may be raising funds in South Africa, or they may be raising funds in our neighboring countries, which are then funneled through our system in South Africa to other parts of the world. A lot of the criticism here was that we are not actively or proactively working on identifying the intelligence networks behind that we need to deal with terrorist financing, and we're not proactively following those to identify terrorist networks that might be operating in South Africa or using the South African territory to raise funds for their activities elsewhere in other parts of the continent or elsewhere in the world. That same criticism followed through on the use, the fact that we don't effectively implement sanctions against terrorist organizations, not even the sanctions that emanate from the Security Council, and that we have a very weak system for implementing those sanctions. And then just lastly, on proliferation financing, that this is a very new aspect that came into the FATF standards only recently, or since the last amendments to our legislation, where countries should also apply financial sanctions coming from the Security Council to freeze assets of entities that are involved in supporting weapons of mass destruction programs in different parts of the world. Our system that is in place is fairly new and wasn't really tested, and therefore the rating was also moderate because we didn't have much to demonstrate that we have an effective system in place. So, Mama, I don't know if you want me to continue. This is basically a summary of all the findings. And I think what next we will be dealing then with the implications of the findings.
Why don't you continue, Peter?
The implications of the findings will be dealt with by the STEM lottery. Over to you, Peter.
Okay. Good morning, Chair, and members of the Portfolio Committee and the colleagues in the National Treasury. My name is Phineas Mulodo. I work in the Financial Intelligence Center. We've been responsible for coordinating this exercise. So as it was said earlier, the MER, which so far we know as a fact, that we didn't perform very well as a country, and that there is an expectation as a jurisdiction that we needed to have effective AML safety systems from legal as well as operational institutions, as well as how we apply those in terms of effectiveness. So then what happens is, what are the consequences in the event that a jurisdiction is found not to be compliant as expected with the standard? And as such, then in the mutual evaluation report, you will see that, and this we also have from slide 19 to 23, if I'm not mistaken, that the report would mention what is wrong with the system, but it doesn't end there. It will say, what are the recommended actions that a jurisdiction will need to do in order to improve its systems? Chair, I see that there is a hand, so I'm not sure if we should pause at this stage or how we should proceed. Thank you.
No, what is the hand for?
Yes, sir. I'm not sure. I cannot find the flatted slides in the documentation that I received. I don't know, Alan, if it is part of the package. Just point us to that direction. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Alan, I think we got a report from the FIC. We don't have this slide presentation. Can you email it to members right now?
Chair, I've sent an updated presentation probably about 9 this morning. So I'm pretty sure they're working off that particular print.
Okay, no, thanks. Continue, Mr. Mlot.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair. So yeah, if you would allow me, Chair, I would like to move quickly on this, I think the next two, three slides, because my colleague Peter Smith has already explained the findings, which also spoke to the weaknesses that were found in the system. So one of the key issues that he mentioned is our ability to know who are the persons that are operating in our financial system or in our companies, as well in terms of trust. So this relates to the issue of beneficial ownership, in which, as we said, you know, we've been found to be very deficient. And the implication there too is that because we may not know who actually owns the warm body behind the companies or the trusts, that it then becomes difficult for our financial institutions to identify and verify the identity of those who are owning the companies when they open business relationships with them or engage in transactions with them. And then similarly, law enforcement agencies will also have difficulties when they investigate. And we see this in a number of investigations that our colleagues in law enforcement are carrying through, that they are unable or they've got major difficulties in identifying the, you know, the people that are behind the criminal activities that would have taken place in terms of identifying the proceeds generated, how they were on that, and so on and so on. So this is one aspect that as a jurisdiction and globally we expected to ensure that we have a system that allows for us to require the registry in terms of the CPC, as well as the Master of the High Court to know the persons and identify those persons that are behind those structures. Next slide. Thank you. And again, another issue which we rated very poorly, and we had you know, a lot of discussions with, you know, with our global partners, is the issue of first our ability to identify and verify, to identify terrorist financing activities that are taking place in our country, and then also have the right measures in place to do so. And the main concern there has been that whether or not we know who a terrorist financing would look like in South Africa, and therefore would we be able to counter that. And this one aspect where we've been found to have a problem. And I think this is not surprising, Chair, if you go earlier to the slides that you don't need to, but when you check in your slides that my colleague Peter Smith presented on our technical compliance, you'll see that the recommendation 5, which is our criminalization of funds for terrorism, our ability to deal with targeted financial sanction from the United Nations Civil Council Resolution, and our ability to know which NPOs are operating in the country, we've been found to be deficient. And as a consequence of that, then it's not surprising that when it comes to the issue of how effectively are we in identifying, investigating, and prosecuting cases related to terrorist financing, we're found to be deficient. And then, of course, the main issue being that, you know, again, our ability to, you know, identify persons that will join the financial sector, and once they're in the financial sector, are we able as supervisory bodies, the Reserve Bank, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, are they able to, you know, ensure that those institutions are supervised and monitored in a way that we focus mainly on those entities that are identified to be high risk, and then put our resources there, because that is the expectation that as a jurisdiction, we should focus more of our resources and energies to the areas where we are most vulnerable. And this area was found to be deficient across all our supervisory bodies, which in essence means that our supervision of our financial institutions and non-bank financial institutions, including, you know, our lawyers, real estate, and so on, is not focusing on those areas that are of major concern in terms of money laundering in the country. Next slide, please. I think I've already presented on this one. We can move to the next one. This is the slide that I was talking about on beneficial ownership. Next slide, please. Okay, yes. So on this one, this slide also made a findings in relation to how well do we cooperate globally. Earlier on, it was mentioned that we seem to be trying to be robust internally, but once a person runs across the border, say, well, we don't show the same robustness to follow suit in that. And we've got a lot of cases in the country where the proceeds were generated in South Africa, and then the funds were taken outside of South Africa to be laundered globally. And the findings were that we did not put enough effort in getting those funds in terms of mutual legal assistance and extraditing those people back into South Africa so that they can face the criminal justice system. And then, of course, lastly, on this slide, deals with our ability to deal with process of crime from other countries which are coming in South Africa. As you are aware, Chair, we are one of the main regional centers in the continent in terms of the sophistication of our financial system, the market opportunities that our country offers. And therefore, we are more attractive to, politically exposed persons. This would be people that are more, having more access and more power in their own countries, who would generate proceeds and then come and launder them into South Africa. So they were saying that we're not, strong enough in pursuing such activities. Next slide, please. Yes, proceed to the next slide. Thank you very much. Yeah, so here, Chair, this is very important, Chair, and I think we need to pause a moment here and then consider, because for us, I think this is the key message. So once a jurisdiction is assessed, depending on its performance, there are different stages where you put into, for purpose of remediating the deficiencies that you face in your MLCFT system. So in order to ensure that there is no arbitrary selection of who goes into what kind of monitoring phase, then the Financial Action Task Force developed a framework which is used objectively to determine the different levels of where a jurisdiction will put into. Earlier on, it was presented that we've got two components to the assessment. The first part is the technical compliance, which looks into the laws and the national framework in the country. The second part is where it looks at, with that understanding of your MLTF risks, how are you using those laws and systems to deal with those risks, and therefore talk about effectiveness. So they consider both elements. One, the effectiveness part, two, the technical compliance, but to determine where you are. And these are the results of your mutual evaluation. So in our case, Jim, it's known to us, we only comply to 50%, and which is very low. And then on top of that, the strategic ones that we have found to be very deficient on, it's the one that deals with terrorist financing, the one that deals with customer due diligence. In other words, the laws that we put in place to ensure that our financial institutions know who they're dealing with. And then, of course, the issue of how well do we deal with targeted financial sanctions that are coming from United Nations Security Council resolution in dealing with terrorist financing. And then, of course, the issue of beneficial ownership, which relates directly to our ability to have information about who are the persons, this natural and legal, that are operating in our financial system in terms of the companies that they own. And then, of course, effectiveness. We know that we did not live up to expectation, 0%, because we have low or moderate, which really means the same thing, which is that our system is not working. So based on that, then we are put in what's called an enhanced follow-up, which means that we have to report more regularly than an ordinary jurisdiction would report. So this now places us in a very precarious situation, because based on this, the FATF president wrote a letter to our Minister of Finance, basically writing to the country, raising those concerns and urging us to address those issues within 1 year of the publication of the evaluation, which was last year, October. And so from October until October this year, then we are expected to have remediated what is called strategic deficiencies. So those strategic deficiencies are mentioned, and for technical compliance, we need to have looked at whether or not our money laundering law is okay. That one we are fine. So we already explained the issue of finance of terrorism, customer due diligence measures, and so on. So that we are fine. So now, what is the most important issue that we need to be facing? Next slide, please. So this is where we are now. We are in an observation period. So we've got 1 year to remediate the shortcomings, the strategic ones. If this is not done so by in October, we submit our progress report. which will be looked at by a region, by a team of experts in our region, which is the African, the Middle East group. If they find that South Africa has not addressed adequately the deficiencies that are identified in the mutual evaluation report, then South Africa will be put in a list called a grey list. So this list, I cannot imagine. I mean, I'm fortunate enough to represent South Africa in this working group, where we look at these countries. The results are devastating to the economies of those regions that are in there. I mean, in some jurisdictions, they lost about 40% of their GDP, of course, depending on the makeup of the economy. In some jurisdictions, the financial could not trade at all. In some, in fact, most that have dealt with directly, the government entities, like your Eskom in our case, Dinel and so on, they could not transact. Even the embassies, they could not transact as they would normally want to, because they are deemed to be coming from a jurisdiction that is high. So there are a lot of implications. So in short here, Chair, on this slide is that we are now in an observation period, which will end in October. In October, South Africa is expected to file a progress report with the Financial Action Task Force, which will be reviewed by a team of experts from October. And then in January, they will meet with South Africa to discuss the extent of progress that we would have made. And then in the event that they find that our progress not, it's not good enough, then of course we'll be put in this enhanced or increased monitoring by the Financial Action Task Force, which will mean that we'll be publicly known as a nation which has insufficient ML safety system. Yeah. So the director will just come in to put one word or two before we move on. Just give
it. Chair, what I want to stress when it comes to this process is that when we file our report, not even in October, but in August, we don't need to show that we've got a strong commitment, we're meeting. We need to show that we've addressed all the deficiencies. If we haven't addressed all the deficiencies, then you are going straight to the ICRG process. That's the ICRG process. That's the process where you are already grey listed. And there's no country really that will want, that will affect the capital coming into the country. There will be no country or any investor that will risk really bringing the money into a country that has been grey listed by FATA, that is known to have those serious strategic deficiencies. So it's very, very critical that we address all, not just partially, all our deficiencies by the end of August. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Director. Maybe we could move to the next slide and speak to some of the challenges that we have. I think we've already spoken about the dire consequences, but maybe Chair, on this one, let me just mention, let's move quickly maybe to bullet number three, just to put things into context. In this case, so once a jurisdiction is on the ICRG list, so the supervisors in other jurisdictions have regard to that situation, and then they then advise, we expected, even ourselves, we do that in South Africa. Every time FATF issues the list at every plenary, we advise our financial institutions of the new list and the concerns that FATF may have in respect of the jurisdictions that are on that list. So what then the supervisor would expect is that inevitably that country is deemed to be coming from, seems to be high risk, and therefore financial institutions or transactions or businesses emanating from that jurisdiction are seen to be posing high risk. And as a result of that, it happens that then everyone else, they've got two options. One is that they will apply enhanced due diligence measures, which is that every transaction that emanates from South Africa or every business that emanates from South Africa will be deemed to be posing a high risk, and therefore they will apply enhanced due diligence measures. In the event that they feel that their systems are not robust enough to absorb the risk that will be emanating from that jurisdiction, in this case South Africa, then they will cut the relationship of what is globally known as de-risking. So they will say, well, look, we don't want to be sanctioned by our regulator. We are not going to take a risk. And this is where now it becomes a problem, because in most cases, a transaction that would normally take two days, 3 days, I would take now 21 days to be processed. And these are practical things, Chair, and I need to stress this because I've been working on this for the last, 10, 15 years now. We've had instances where government or senior government officials have traveled to outside of the country. Their credit card did not work because they were deemed to be coming from a juicy that is problem. Transactions were hanging forever while businesses were struggling to engage in international trade as it should be. And this is done because overseas banks fear sanctions from their own from their own supervisors. But in the event that we deal with this transaction, we are going to be sanctioned. And we've seen this where they've just de-risking. In the region, we did a de-risking study about 3 years ago, and the results were very shocking. That a number of financial institutions were cut off from this part of the world because generally we're deemed to be, as a region, that was higher risk. And then it doesn't end there. So you've got the FATF list, which is considered by all members of FHS. Then you've got the regional economic groupings, such as the European Union, who, as soon as FATF publishes that list, they also publish their own list. So kind of they replicate that list, but the questions are even more dire. Because in their case, whereas with FATF, we'll have one-on-one sessions where we can show them we're making progress and so on. With the EU grade listing, it becomes even more difficult because the EU moves as a unison. They move with the understanding that once you're on their list, all EU members, which in our case, it will be devastating, that they must take certain measures, including enhanced due diligence measures or cutting off the relationships. They won't say that, but that's what inevitably happens because financials will then be afraid to deal with that. And we've been seeing this a lot. I mean, I can mention a few countries that I work with within the FATF area. Botswana was having huge difficulties. They just came out recently. Mauritius was horrible for them as an international financial center. They just had, they got out of the list, I think about 2 months ago or a month ago. Ghana, we spoke when we went on site to remove Ghana from the list. The minister, the horror stories that he was explaining about the consequences were very bad. And then Tunisia, I don't know how many times Tunisia traveled to Brussels to speak to the EU. And the EU has said, no, fix your issues as FATF. Once you've done that, you can come back to us. So these are the practicalities. And when you look in terms of international trade between South Africa and the EU, we cannot afford as a jurisdiction to be on the grey list, which would inevitably mean that we'll be on the EU list. So those are some of the consequences that we deal with. And then, of course, we've got the independent list that will come from your United States. You've got the UK in terms of how much the Treasury, and so on and so on. All this will have material impact on our ability to trade as a jurisdiction. And where we are now with our ailing economy, which really, really is thirsty for foreign direct investment, I think this will be very devastating for a jurisdiction of our size. Can you move to the next slide, please? Okay, yeah, I think this we have discussed, Chair. We wouldn't want to spend more time on this. The next slide. Okay. So maybe Chair, we can pause here and then hand to you, Chair. Yes. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks, Director Phineas. So Chair, I think I wanted you to I think it was important for committee members to hear in a manner of speaking from, I shouldn't say the horse's mouth, lest I be accused of something else, but really from the FIC colleagues who really have done sterling work. They've, they get into the nitty gritty of the mutual evaluation and what each standard and each effectiveness outcome means, and they can really provide gory detail. And in fact, my fight with them is to say, can you please keep it simple? And I know they're not scaring us, but we should be scared, Chair, I think, from what they've just said, because I guess in the words of one Jay Foster, the consequences are too ghastly to contemplate if we get onto the grey listing. Okay, so so I think, but let me just say that I think, Chair, there is a path. I don't sometimes differ with them slightly by saying they've been a bit too bleak. I think that there is a path forward. How do we find light at the end of this tunnel? I think just from what, like Finja says, outlined in the director, you can see that the consequences, and I agree with what they're saying on the slide, the consequences, it's really, and let me say this, Chair, even before we get into the grey list, in the financial sector, banks and others are already taking action because of the bad mutual evaluation, because they anticipate, they take a view on whether they think we'll get onto the grey list or not. So it's not even what's going to happen there, but in the coming months, if we're not seen to comply or taking steps that will get us to comply, they're going to anticipate. Now, I think what the Treasury, and I'm going to just outline what the process we have in government to deal with this. But as you've seen, honorable members, that this issue is not just Treasury and FIC and maybe one or two others like DTI, but it does involve the intelligence agencies, it involves the criminal prosecution authorities, it involves the Department of Justice. And a lot is about, for example, when we get the Security Council listing, it's not followed up. The intelligence on terrorist financing, it's not something that some of us at Treasury or anywhere would deal with those issues. If we need, and I know there's a fancier word, getting into it, it's not just having the mechanisms for international cooperation and for us to provide information when we request it, but the thing is that we don't seem to be making requests at all when we deal with overseas issues. So, you know, you can take the issue of the Gupta family there in Dubai. Do our authorities actually use all the mechanisms, and that's what this assessment, it's not looking at any particular case, but it's saying, South Africa, you guys hardly ever asked us for information. So, Chair, when we looked at this as National Treasury and as government, and when we took this matter to Cabinet, because obviously it's serious, we took it last year, just after or around the time of the when the mutual evaluation was approved, we took it to Cabinet. And I think the big point we were making is that whilst this evaluation only focused obviously on money laundering, on terrorist financing, actually a lot of its points apply to all financial crimes. You know, it's not that we are just saying on money laundering, this is what we are not doing, but generally we are weak at dealing with financial crimes. And our, you know, I don't want to get into the whole discussion of the role of our, or the capability of our intelligence agencies to actually be on top of the issues. I don't deal with them directly in any way, because obviously they operate in a particular way. But what this evaluation is saying is that we fail all those tests and we don't act. Whether we have the intelligence or not, we don't act. So in a sense, what we're saying is that it therefore covers our lack of capability in dealing with general corruption, dealing with looting of state-owned entities, procurement fraud. You can take the COVID PPE story, financial fraud like Steinhoff, BBS Bank, Tongard, you name it, Chair. The weaknesses are there for all of these, and I know we all get frustrated that not much is happening, but this, what the mutual evaluation says is we've got serious problems, and this is what we say to others. We're not doing this because of FATF and so on. The peer review is actually good, but for our own sake, and our own capability, we really got to focus on this. And so we clearly need to have better forensic capability in the criminal justice system. This was a big area identified. Chair, we also find that our agencies, even between themselves, don't share. You know, they may share information in terms of their legal requirements, but is it really being shared effectively? Often there's confidentiality issues. So if you're a taxpayer, SARS can't provide certain information. Even the FIC and the current legislation, I don't believe, I may be wrong, and there's many advocates on that side in the FIC who can correct me. But in terms of the way the law is written currently, if there's procurement, they can't really provide info to or share that info with agencies that can't investigate. So the OCPO doesn't have any legislative status as such. So all those issues come in. They've got to have certain powers for the director to provide that kind of information. Aside from dealing with the culture that agencies don't readily share the information and don't work as effectively together as they should, okay, and I'm putting it very mildly, I think that the whole issue of the legal provisions enabling the forfeiture of unexplained wealth also clearly needs to be strengthened so that by default it almost becomes crime. So this, Chair, was just our assessment that in dealing with the FATF, the weaknesses outlined, that it would actually help us as a country on our attempts to deal with corruption, with dealing with fraud in the private sector, with dealing with illegal flows, all of that. We'd be able to make progress on if we act on those weaknesses. Next slide, please.
Momo, can I come in before you proceed on that one?
Sure. And correct me as well, Director.
Yeah, no, I'm not just correcting you, Momo. When it comes to the first point, Momo, I just want to really indicate to the members of the committee that this report has revealed that 50% of the crimes that are reported at our police stations is proceeds-generating crimes. So it's very critical that we have the right skills that will assist us to successfully investigate such crimes. And those skills don't just require your ordinary investigators. You need people who are skilled in cyber, people who understand data, how to really make means and deal with data and make it to be more structured and organized. You need also forensic analysts. You need people who will be able to receive a report from the FIC on intelligence products from the FIC and give meaning to that product so that that product can be used in the investigations, in the prosecutions, in the forfeiture of assets. In the ACCT, we already have a team that is being led by SARS. FIC is also part of the team, SIU, the Hawks, Peter, you remind me, Asset Forfeiture Unit. And we are looking into the issues of building a state forensic capability so that within that state, we have that capability to be able to deal with the financials, to be able to produce a report, a forensic report, and take that forensic report to court. Another process that we are also looking at still in the ACCT is also being led by SARS, FIC, as Asset Forfeiture. It's also looking at unexplained wealth, because in the national risk assessment that we have done, Phineas will touch on IO1, we have picked up that there's a lot of cash in the country, in the system, and it's cash that you cannot explain. And you cannot really say to a person, explain where this cash is coming from. It's up to the state to really to prove beyond reasonable doubt that you are carrying cash that amounts to, which represents proceeds of crime. But there's no obligation on a person who is carrying cash and can't explain where the cash is coming from. So that's one area that we need to really close as a country so that we can be effective in fighting financial crime. So that's what I wanted to add, Momo, whilst you are still there. As you have indicated, Momo, on those big cases of Steno, we seem to be assisting countries when they come to us and say, give me information. But when it comes to our own cases, we seem to really lack in going out there and say, request, assist me with this information so that I can move with this case. And not only charge policy or Momo, but also charge legal entities that are involved in such cases, companies, because people hide their ill-gotten gains through companies and trusts. So those are the critical gaps that we need to be closing.
No, thank you, Tarek. And let me say, you know, we've received strong backing, I would say, from cabinet and our political principles. But I think there are also just process issues. So we are waiting the, as the president has said, you know, the last report of the Commission on State Capture will be coming towards the end of this month. And in a sense, some of the proposed, the president has said that by June we'll respond. Now, time is not on our side, but certainly internally, I think those recommendations will also, I would assume, affect how we respond or particular areas. So we've got to sort of bring these processes, I guess, together so that there's, So just to move on, I think as the FIC colleagues have outlined, you know, this is as bad as getting a terrible investment grade, if not worse. So we did a lot to deal with our investment ratings. In a way, this is going to be have a bigger impact than that. And I don't think that we are being dramatic here or trying to scare people, but we do need to take notice. Chair, I don't think we need to go through the explanations. Maybe just go through we don't need to direct. I think we've been through all of this, but we've just left you with a lot more slides on the next steps. We can come back and provide much more detail. But as I said, I just want to outline to you the process. Let's go through the. I don't think we need to go through the slides unless directly you want to come in on any of them. But I think
Important, Mom. I think you can proceed and we come back to the action plan, because it's very critical that the members understand that there is an action plan that has been developed and we need to go back to FATF in October and show that we have addressed that action plan, that all those actions have been fully addressed and not partially addressed. Because when they are partially addressed, we are running with speed really towards the grey listing.
Yes, no, that's fine. So let's just, Chair, we've just provided these slides to say the type of action steps that are being considered. Next slide. You can just go through it just to bring to the attention of members, and if FIC colleagues want to explain later, they can explain. Next slide.
Phineas will deal with them.
Do you want to deal with it? Okay, deal with it.
This Mom, I think we still have time. Phineas,
no, that's fine. That's fine. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mom. Thank you, Chair. So maybe if we could go back to the earlier slide, the first slide. No, I think slide number 18. Sorry, slide number 18. Yes. So here I'm going to highlight the main issues so that if there are discussions later on, we can always come back to it. So let me start by saying that this slide links directly to slide number 9, which my colleague Peter Smith presented on earlier on. And then to say that the most important thing why we do the assessment is not so much to find fault in the system, but rather to find areas of improvement. And this now lies in the recommended actions that you see under, when you find time to read the report, under each chapter, it will start with key findings, then below it, then there are recommended actions. It is on the basis of those recommended actions that a jurisdiction is expected to develop an action plan, which would be the basis upon which it put all its laws and resources to actually address the deficiencies that it faced with. In our case, just to highlight to the members, we have a cabinet-approved interdepartmental working group, which is chaired by the FIC, which comprises all relevant stakeholders in government that are responsible for MLCFT. And then we also have below that sub-working groups. We established the sub-working groups mainly because we wanted to focus, we want agencies to focus on the main issues that they are faced with. So we'll have a sub-working group for each immediate outcome. So we'll have a sub-working group that works with the national risk assessment, sub-working group on internal cooperation, sub-working groups on supervision and financial, just to make sure that agencies are not all over the place. We're able to put our focus on areas of importance and can share between those different sub-working groups. In this regard, we developed a national action plan, which was approved by cabinet. And then following that, then in the interdepartmental working group itself, then we tried to stagger some of the recommended actions. And then we have completed a prioritization of the action plans, which, I mean, action items that needs to be implemented. So now the slide before you talks to what the assessors saw as areas that South Africa needed to improve on. And then we extract those and then say, what are the things that we need to do in order to achieve that which has been asked of us as a jurisdiction? So the basis for an effective MLCFT system is to understand the money laundering and terrorist financing that are facing the country. In other words, if we know who are the people, who are the entities that are likely to expose us and where we would be exposed in terms of our vulnerability, then that gives us, you know, the strength to actually focus on the areas of high importance. In this case, South Africa was found not to have a robust understanding of money laundering and terrorist financing. What then happened is that through the IDC, which is the Interdepartmental Committee on AML, CFT, which is chaired by the National Treasury, then I established the National Risk Assessment Working Group, which now is focusing on doing risk assessment. They're almost complete on terrorist financing as well as money laundering. And those two would be the basis upon which we base our MLCFT system on. And out of that, because one criticism was that, was not that South Africa doesn't actually deal with MLCFT, but whether our activities are focused on high-risk areas. In order to channel that, then we need to have an MLCFT strategy as a country that drives within government point of view, what are the areas that we need to focus on? And then one of that key issues relates to the issue of reliance on cash. This will deal with later on, Chair. So we'll just keep it from this point. So under IO1, we are currently completing two national risk assessments on money laundering and terrorist financing. What will then remain is the strategy on combating money laundering and terrorist financing. So we can move on to the immediate outcome two. This one I'm going to be very quick. Here is to say that how much effort are we putting in pursuing the process that left the country to different jurisdictions. We are aware that some of these funds went as far as the United States, the UK, the UAE, and how much are we dealing with this? And these are laid out there in the first and second report of the state capture, which this is well known in government, that some of these projects left the country for other jurisdictions. So we will be expected as a jurisdiction to have a system in place that actually pursue those and bring those funds back home, but also extra that those individuals that need to face the might of the law in the country. And then under supervision, the main issue here were actually, I would say, just sum them up as two. The main one is that, how well do we know that our financial trade is not penetrated by criminals? And in this case, as we discussed earlier on, how robust are the regulatory systems, the licensing, the resident system of the supervisor, your reserve bank, your financial sector conduct authority, the real estate, the lawyers, and so on and so on. So this is the area that we need to strengthen, because one key area, and then this is very surprising, is that when we license, we don't check at criminal records and so on. So these are the things that we need to get. And then, of course, to what extent our financial institutions are following this space approach when financial supervisors, rather, when they supervise this entity. So this is an area that at the moment, we are aware that the PA, which is the Prudential Authority within the Reserve Bank, FISCA, the Reserve Bank, they are working tirelessly to ensure that they establish this. And we work with them on a regular basis to monitor them within that sub-working group that I spoke about in terms of supervision. So there is some traction in this area. And then, of course, we'll see in August when we file the report whether or not the actions will be deemed to be sufficient by the FATF. And then the next one that is related to them is immediate outcome four. Here again, the main issue that is, was required was that the assessors found that whilst our private sector apply controls in place to know who they are dealing with, they are not doing this on a risk sensitive basis. This is mainly because as a country we have not yet developed an ML, a money laundering and risk assessment. And the completion of the immediate outcome one, which is doing the risk assessment, would also assist greatly for these private sector parties to also use that report to see which ones apply to them directly, so that when they develop their own risk understanding and, of course, their compliance programs, they'll be based on a better risk understanding. And this will serve us very well in terms of, one, knowing who should be in the system, two, identifying those transactions that need to be reported to the FIC for processing to law enforcement agencies. So that way it will help us to deal with high-risk transactions. Immediate outcome five, you can move to the next slide. This one, I think we spoke at length. It's a very simple thing. We have obligation under the G20 as South Africa to ensure that we've got beneficial ownership information. And this directly leads to the Register of Companies as well as the Master of the High Court. And this will assist, as we said, law enforcement agencies, the regulators themselves when they license, as well as the private sector entities when they identify and verify their customers to tap into that database to know who they are dealing with, who they are licensing, and who they are investigating. And this will make our system work very efficiently. So immediate outcome six, Chair, if maybe we could move to the next slide, I'll link this six with the next slide. So with the immediate outcome six, the reason why I didn't want to spend time on it is that there was actually no negative finding in relation to South Africa's ability to produce quality financial intelligence. The issue was how well is this information being used by law enforcement agencies to investigate, prosecute, and commit and seize assets that are related to that. So that is the main issue that we need. So at the moment, we'll be looking at what strategies do we have in terms of financial investigation, prosecution, and not just of any case, but complex financial crime case in particular. How well are we using those strategies to deal with state capture related matters? So the issue of the state capture reduced throughout the report in terms of, how well it has penetrated our financial sector and then, the fabric, the social fabric in total. So we need to ensure that we have steps sufficient enough to deal with this. Earlier on, Momo spoke about establishing a forensic capability as a country to deal with this. And I think that we really need to have this going as soon as possible, including our ability also to deal with the cybercrime issues which the director spoke about. So we really need to make sure that we don't go for the low-hanging cases, that we actually go for the strong ones that where they will have major impact. So the DPCI, the NPA, the FIC, the Reserve, so the Revenue Authority needs to work together to ensure that they identify and prosecute those particular cases. And the immediate outcome eight, Chair, here, truth be told, that we get good findings on this one. The main issue here was simply because we do not as yet as South Africa have a declaration system. In other words, at the border, when people are coming in or leaving, whether or not they've got cash with them and that they need to declare. And you will recall that earlier on the immediate outcome one, I said I'll come back to this. This is the main issue for the assessors, which is that we are unable to determine the nature and extent of cash that comes in and go out of the country. And the system that we should be doing is that when you arrive at any point of entry in South Africa, you should be able to declare that you have these funds of this nature, and then that information then is related to different types of law enforcement agencies to deal with it. At the moment, I know that the South African Revenue Service, the FIC, and the Treasury are working on having this activated so that this information could quickly be made available. So there is traction in this area, and we hope that the colleagues will do that. And again, recently we had the BMA that has come into force, which will also, in our view, contribute greatly to strengthening this part. Once Chair speaks to terrorist financing, so I'll just maybe speak to them at once quickly so that we can move to the other slides, which is that, and I say this in a number of forums, and I think I should say this in this forum as well, but for a country of our stature as South Africa, which moves and believes that our prosperity and development relies on the peace and stability of the continent and the world. One of the key risk factors in terms of the security issues that the world is faced with now is terrorism. And that terrorism can only happen if there are those that are financed. So if we have the ability to know who are the financiers, then we are most likely to deal with the issues of terrorism. So in South Africa's case, I need to say this, Chair, and please just allow me to stress it, because when the assessors come and say our intelligence service, our law enforcement agencies do not understand what a terrorist financier would look like in South Africa, it's a serious indictment, because what it actually means that we would not be able to know who's likely to commit terrorist acts in South Africa. So we wouldn't know and identify the person to blow up the Reserve Bank, blow up the Union buildings, blow up Parliament, blow up the Gautrain Bridge. We wouldn't know that, because we wouldn't know who are these people that are willing or have the willingness to commit this. And one of the key areas that was found is that we need to ensure that in our counterterrorism strategy, we embed the issue of financing of terrorism so that is the daily bread of intelligence, the intelligence community, the law enforcement agents. And then, of course, take that information and interact more closely with the private sector, especially the banking system, so that we can assist them to identify those transactions that have possible links, and then they'll be able to report them to the FIC for processing and so on. So this is the main issue that we need to look at in terms of IO9. The next one relates to immediate outcome 10. Here again, Chair, we have a legal basis to issue this or implement the United Nations Security Council resolution relating to asset freeze of terrorist financiers. But the main concern here is that we don't have a criteria and a process to actually list. If we were to identify such a person, there is no process in this country that we can use to list that. So we need to build this into our system. And we are a member of the national the Security Council. We are then the members of the United Nations. We subscribe to Chapter 7, which promotes peace and security globally. And that one aspect that has to deal with that is terrorism. And therefore, where people are identified, either in South or outside of South, we should be able to list that. And the assessors were able to establish that there are a number of cases where South should actually have listed domestically or referred individuals to the United Nations Security Council structure that deals with this, and we didn't, because we don't have a process in place that deals with that. And then, of course, the main concern is the issue of a non-profit organization. Here we need to hasten and mention that it's not all NPOs. It is the duty of South Africa to identify which NPOs are likely to be abused for financing of terrorism, and then focus our energies on them, educating them on these issues, making sure that they've got systems in place, ensuring that SARS, SIPSI, the MASTA, as well as DSD, that is the Department of Social Development, have an understanding of those entities that are likely to be used for financing of terrorism, regulate and monitor them. And if that is the case, then you should be able to have a proper way of dealing with them. The remaining slide, Chair, really similar concerns that we have on the slides that we just ended now under immediate outcome 10. So in short, we are required to do one is to make sure that we understand our risks through the risk assessment that are ongoing now, and they should be completed, I think, from the group that we spoke around July. That's one. Two, develop an AML safety strategy that will hopefully that drives government's approach, so that when someone comes and say, what is the government's approach to anti-money laundering and financial, you can say, this document speaks to us. All government agencies that deal with this and the private sector will then develop their priorities and objectives in line with them, so that our measures that we're implementing are consistent with the risks that we understand. And of course, we need to review them so that there's dynamism in terms of understanding of risk as well as the measures that we put in place. This will ensure that the private sector, the supervisory bodies, are able to do that which they need to do, to identify those persons that are likely to use the system for nefarious reasons, related to money laundering, terrorist finance, and then report those to the different supervisory bodies, including the Financial Intelligence Center, who then work that information, transfer it to law enforcement agencies, the DPCI, and so on, to investigate them. Once they are satisfied that they meet the threshold, working together with the National Prosecuting Authority, then they will be able to prosecute, and ultimately the court will make a decision. And in that way, it's the only way we can demonstrate to the global community and to ourselves, of course, that we are a country that takes anti-money laundering and counterfeiting of terrorism measures in a good way. And if we're able to do this, I can most certainly say that whenever we'll be assessed again, we'll be able to show a good report than the one that we are showing now. And of course, we need to make sure that in August we file a good report, and this is the way that we can do. Thank you, Chair. So I'll hand over to a few points to make. Thank you very much.
I have nothing to add. I'll hand over to Mom.
Okay, no, thank you. Next slide. Okay, Chair, so just in terms of how we as government are dealing with this, as I think we've stated a few times, Cabinet had, in fact, already in 2018, set up an interdepartmental committee, which is chaired by the Director General of the National Treasury, is attended by many of the, as members have DGs or their representatives from, justice, police, or most of the criminal justice departments, and then other relevant departments like DTI, social development, and also agencies like SARS, of course, the FIC, and some of the financial sector regulators also are members. It has underneath it a working task team that has been meeting much more often, and it starts really to develop, I think, some of the key documents like the risk assessments and a broad strategic document. But this forum obviously makes sure that there's collaboration, communication, and info sharing between all the different parties. And as I said, the focus is not just to deal with this as a technical compliance approach, that is important, but to also the financial system more broadly. We've talked about the need for greater collaboration, and I think just improving some of the issues in our system, like your suspicious and unusual transaction reporting. At the moment, for example, there's a lot of low quality reports, but I think just and cases maybe sometimes get drowned by the volume because there's not been any assessment made upfront. Next slide. So, Chair, I think for today it's just and we were happy to have been called just to note the very serious implications of the poor rating, that we are in an enhanced follow-up, and therefore we do need to have significant progress as the directors outline by August. And Chair, that's why we will be coming with legislation probably in April to at least do the easier bit, which is to deal with some of the legislative changes that are necessary to get us on the road to deal with the weaknesses. But the bigger issue is going to be the issue of cooperation and getting all the agencies, I think, to focus on, as I've said, all financial crimes, whether it's corruption, illegal financial flows, and so on. And Chair, I'll stop there. Members have questions. I don't know if the director has any more she wants to say before we hand over to you, Director.
I think I just want to indicate more that at some stage, at an appropriate time, we will have to bring the National Risk Assessment report to the committee.
And I think just for the chair maybe to know that you can see that, chair, that on the one hand, there's many other players here. Firstly, there's all the regulators who you could have invited for today if you wanted to as a committee. But even beyond just those that normally report to the standing committee, to SCOP, there is the criminal justice authorities and so on. And, you know, you may want to just hear from them how they're responding as well to this report. But I leave that to you, Chair. Thank you, Chair, and honourable members.
Okay. Thanks, Mom. The director, FIC, the entire team from FIC, Treasury, and other entities. Thanks for the presentation. Now let's move to item 3. Questions for clarity, comments by members. For now, I see the hand of Dr. George, Honorable Mavileta, Honorable Abraham. Yeah, let's take those for now. Dr. George, over to you.
Thanks, Chairperson, and thanks very much for the presentation. Yes, I agree, it is quite troubling that it looks the way that it does. While you were doing the presentation, I was just giving thoughts to what is happening locally. I mean, we put in a lot of laws, et cetera, that quite frankly seem to make it very difficult for ordinary people, for example, to do banking. So, for example, you go to the bank, you've got to give a whole lot of documentation. There's a source of money that gets checked for certain transactions, etc. So there's lots of hurdles that your ordinary person needs to climb over. And then there's regular checks, for example, that the banks do to make sure they know who their clients are, etc. Obviously, I would presume with the intention of knowing who they're dealing with, so that if there's any person who may well be, I don't know, using lots of cash transactions, for example, or might be laundering or using proceeds of terrorism or something, that they would then be identified. So, I mean, certainly for the person in the street, it seems quite an onerous exercise to navigate the basic financial things that need to be done. But yet we have this kind of feedback. So I want to know, is this the result of our focus being in the wrong place? So in other words, if South Africa is focusing very heavily on, if you want to call that, the easy targets, for example, so your average person going about their business, making life, quite frankly, quite difficult sometimes, but not really getting anywhere, so not catching anybody, etc. And perhaps that is a low risk category that gets the burden, whereas possibly other individuals who can navigate the system more effectively get away with it, and that requires a lot more sophisticated systems, processes, etc. So I mean, certainly as a member of parliament, I do get lots of people saying, well, you know, these laws are so onerous. But at the same time, we get this feedback. So are we actually going down the right road? And, you know, are sort of your average law-abiding citizens being really heavily burdened for no reason whatsoever because we're not actually getting anywhere in terms of doing the things that these laws are supposed to be preventing. So, yeah, that's my question, Chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. George. Honorable Mavileta.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Momo and team, and the team from FIC and Director. And we welcome the presentation. And I've just noted, you know, more especially on the treasury assessment, and I got a bit worried. But even though you also have an action plan later on and proposed that, but these issues that I'm just going to repeat now, they were repeated again. I know Momo has really overemphasized them. What got me worried was need to develop capacity to deal with crimes and corruption, and you have those under assessment. And also, they need to have better forensic and capability in our critical justice system. And also, you also noted that a need for better sharing of information between all these various agencies and how confidentiality is understood and on critical information shared. I think you're also like mainly talking about communication strategy. But then all these things, you know, for you to succeed, you depend that they should be resolved. You know, you need to resolve urgently so that these issues on your assessment, you know, they are resolved so that you have a better outcome. And well, on the proposed steps to improve country, you also mentioned them. So I'm a really bit worried that, you know, we will monitor. It's not really a question. We'll continue to monitor and have maybe another presentation for your progress so that these issues are resolved. Because if they are not resolved, we are not really going to be able to achieve what you would like to do. I mean, need to have better forensic and capability in our critical justice. It means that it's not there. So I'm just a bit worried and I'm just commenting. But anyway, thank you for the presentation.
Thanks, Honorable Mabilati. Honorable Abraham.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. Let me also join the colleagues who have welcomed the presentation. And I just want to commend the team for the teamwork. And I want to agree with one of the last presenters who said the issue is not us complying with international standards, but complying with international standards also keeps us in check, because sometimes when you don't have anything to compare yourself to, you might just think that you are doing the best. Thank you so much for the presentation. So I want to start where I interrupted the presenters with the presentation and probably register a concern, because the presentation that we got, Chair, was also a slides presentation. It was a slides presentation that we got on time and were able to go through. However, I want to register the fact that the latest presentation that was used was sent late. So I think the the presenters probably sent to Alan while the meeting was starting already, hence it was 9:10. Just wanted to register that, Chair, so that we are understood if for some reason we got lost. For example, coming to my questions. Chair, there is a date that is in the new presentation that Momo spoke to, which is the commencement of the process of evaluation, which is April 2019. But in the presentation that you were sent, it says May 2018. So I think, though it might sound like it's not so important, but it is it is important to know what you are dealing with in terms of the dates that we're coming from or when we started, because also our progress can be based on that. Still in the background, I see Momo indicates that there was a break of almost a year due to COVID-19. My question there, Chair, is whether FATF was not able to work virtually during the time, just to keep each other in check. And I'm not going to dwell too much on the areas of weakness, because, Chair, my belief is that in the action plan that is going to be shared with us, they are going to share the areas where they are going to be improving. So, Chair, I will just pass the slides that talk to the compliance ratings with a comment that says, I think we need to know when the presenters are saying that they do work with departments, we need to know which departments for sure, because I think based on the areas of weakness, for me, the departments, there are departments that are critical for participation, especially because we do have an endorsement by cabinet in terms of a committee that should work around these funds. And so for me, it's quite critical that we know who is part of the committee so that we are also able to say in our other deployments, why are you not contributing towards ensuring that we deal profitably or effectively with the issues of cross-border financing. Chair, I think also in the areas that have been marked as low, my expectation is that the work that's being done at that level. So I will just go to a question or three questions. The one that wants to know whether there has been some contribution by FIC to assist the Zondo Commission in any way. Have you been able or have you been called upon to assist at that level? Now, secondly, maybe also related, did the bank accounts of both Ogbay and Gupta companies, did their closure, not constitute a tipping off offense in terms of FICA? What is your take on that? And if it did, then did FICA take action against the implicated banks? That of course depends on your response. Chair, the money that was identified to have gone into the wrong hands, was it practical, or did FIC manage to have the funds frozen, or is it not something that they could do? My last question, or my second last question, Chair, is whether as an intelligence organization, the FIC falls under the jurisdiction of the Inspector General of Intelligence? If not, except for I'm sorry, Chair, my battery is going low. I'm not sure if I... Okay, let me close my video. If not, then who oversights FIC? I mean, when things go wrong, when there's faltering within, who makes sure that you account? And lastly, on the spaza shops, do we have some kind of are we able to ensure that they do have bank accounts in the country? Because I think that's one of the big questions when it comes to them not banking their money locally. Now, do we or have we picked up some suspicious transactions in that sector? If you could enlighten us on that. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the presentation once more.
Thanks, Honorable Abraham. Honorable Skasana, Glanish.
No, Ngiyathokoza Sihlalo. And greetings to all honorable members and our officials from the National Treasury and the FIC. I would like to join other members, I think, in welcoming the presentation. I think the presentation is quite good. I think it's to a larger extent, it does address a number of challenges that we are faced with, and challenges in the main that have an impact on our revenue. Because year in, year out, when we have to deal with the issue of budget, I think these issues are issues that are coming to say we are unable to collect the necessary revenue because of these kind of challenges, because of financial crimes that have to do with illegal financial flows, the issues of tax evasion, the issues of money laundering, etc. So I think this presentation, I think it does, I think, give the necessary solutions, I think, to those challenges which are facing us. And I think it is quite important, as they've indicated, that it should not only be an issue of compliance with international requirements, but it should also be about assisting us as a country, I think, to combat these particular crimes, and also for us to be able to have the necessary revenue. But what I just need to find out, Chair, is whether since the establishment of the interdepartmental cabinet committee, which is led by the National Treasury DG in 2018, comparatively, since the establishment of that particular committee, is there any good story to tell? Can we say comparatively, since that committee was established in 2018 to date, when you compare this period to the prior 2018 period, is there a good story to tell? Can we say indeed this committee has been able to assist us? Are we able to crack, I think, some of these crimes? Are we able to win this battle against these financial crimes? Thanks, Slav.
Okay, thanks. Let me make a comment and ask a question. In the problem statement,
you identified the deficiencies in terms of the legal regime, that there are loopholes in terms of the legislative framework, which is there. But if I look here at the FICA Act, it has been amended, I think, once or twice, I'm not sure. In the object of that act, it says that to establish a financial intelligence center, counter money laundering advisory council in order to combat money laundering activities and the financing of terrorists and related activities, to impose certain duties on institutions and other persons who might be used for money laundering purposes, and the financing of terrorists and related activities, to clarify the application of the Act in relation to other laws, to provide for the sharing of information by the center and supervisory bodies, to provide for the issuance of directives by the center and supervisory bodies, to provide for the registration of accountable and reporting institutions, to provide for the roles and responsibilities of supervisory bodies, to provide for written arrangements relating to the respective roles and responsibilities of the center and supervisory bodies, to provide the center and supervisory bodies with powers to conduct inspection, to regulate certain applications to court, to provide for administrative sanctions that may be imposed by the center and supervisory bodies, to establish an appeal board to hear appeals against decisions of the center or supervisory bodies, to amend the Prevention of Organized Crime Act 1998 and the Promotion of Access to Information Act 2000, and to provide for matters connected therewith. So with all this in the objectives of the Act, are we not able to deal with money laundering and deal with issues of terrorist-related activities? I just want to understand when you say there are deficiencies in the Act, because this Act has also been amended at some stage because maybe it was not tight enough. Which legislations are deficient, so that we should not say there are deficiencies in the laws without mentioning those acts? Because the FICA Act on its own is so clear as to what is it that the state should do. And I think if we can do what is contained in the object of a FICA Act, we can be able to deal with some of the issues that are raised here. And if you say that criminal enterprises channel their proceeds through trusts and companies, how do they conduct those transactions? Because a company on its own, as a juristic person, can't conduct a transaction. A director or a signatory of that company is the one who conducts the transaction, the channeling of money, withdrawal, deposit, and so on. And all of us who are here in this platform, we have got bank accounts. Somewhere December, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was November, I was busy with arranging. It was after the funeral of my younger sister. It was during the funeral of my younger sister. There was money that I have to get from a burial society to pay for funeral activities. My bank account was blocked. And when I called my banker, she said, no, you haven't submitted the municipal statement, the latest one. You haven't submitted your salary statement from parliament and so on and so on. So I had to go to the municipality to get the statement, call parliament to send me a salary advice. And I'm not a terrorist. I don't think the APSA was suspecting that I'm a terrorist. But it was because they were saying that the statements, the information that they have at their disposal was outdated. So how do these other companies that conduct criminal activities through trusts and companies do that with all these tight regulations when it comes to doing banking in South Africa. Because wherever you go, even when you have to buy a car, there has to be FICA requirements that you must go through. So just explain in simple terms as to how does this happen. I'm not sure if the registrar of banks or whosoever from provincial authorities in the platform, that how possible is this, because they deal with the banks on a daily basis. And lastly, the NPA. So you said the NPA does not have the necessary or the requisite skills to deal with some of these criminal activities. So what is the challenge with the NPA? Because they seem to be part of your IDC. Because if we don't have a capable NPA, even if you take cases to a court of law, it will be very difficult for judges to make any judgment in favor of the NPA if the case is not tight enough. Thanks very much. Over to you, FIC and Treasurer.
Maybe let me start, because I think the director will have all the hard questions to answer. Roche, I think, I think the point that Honorable George made is there's no doubt that your anti-money laundering legislation is onerous. It's actually draconian and probably generates the biggest expense for banks, for example, because there's customer due diligence, or another way of seeing it is know your customer is a kind of key principle that they have to enforce. And Chair, and you know, there's many issues. I mean, when we amended the Act in 2015, you know, this frustration, Chair, that you feel that they want your municipal account, they want this, is actually the lazy way for institutions to proceed. And we changed the law so that, and the FIC colleagues can come in on exactly how we changed it. But to move away from this thing of two documents and then you're okay, they need to take a risk-based approach. And really, they act smarter. They don't really need to do all of that. And certainly, your salary, Chair, would be well known you from Parliament and so on. So I think it can be annoying. And I think, as Honourable George has also put it, there's a lot of hurdles in a sense for the person in the street to fill in this form, that form, etc. I think the key point, and Phineas made this, is that of institutions understanding a risk-based approach. And often my feeling is that they don't take the risk-based approach because that is, in a sense, harder, and having a simple tick box, oh, you got the ID of the person, oh, you got the municipal account, kind of is an easy way for people to deal with it. And we had hoped that having done the legislation, that there would be smarter ways of checking. Second point I think that's important to note is that by and large, I think your big institutions, especially those that are listed, have such reputational concerns that they tend to comply. Even if you didn't have the FIC Act, they would comply, because if they want to do business or have a correspondent banking relationship, they have to almost comply to the highest standards of the other countries that they're dealing with for them to be able to do business with banks and so on in that country, in the other countries. But it's once you go to smaller companies that on the one hand maybe it's very burdensome from a compliance perspective for those companies, but also it's very hard to deal with them. So you deal with motor car dealers who deal in cash, estate agents who deal in cash, and in a sense, the sort of cash economy. And I think if one just followed, even just on TV, the Zondo Commission and OSASA and the cash, I mean, that is one of our big problems, is how do you deal with this cash economy, which is difficult. So though we've got many laws, I think getting this to apply by many regulators who aren't who don't even fall under the finance portfolio, but clearly impact on us, on the country as a whole, is a huge challenge. In terms of capability and so on, I think it's all out there in the public domain about our weaknesses and how long cases or investigations take. But there's many players here, so you can't even say, I would suspect it's the NPA, because before the NPA, there's the Hawks who have to investigate. They have to presumably do a docket. I'm not an expert in this area. The advocate here will definitely be an expert in this area, given where she comes from in her past life. So perhaps she can tell us. But just broadly, I think that, yes, it's onerous. Yes, I think that it's not a question that maybe I'll focus on the areas that we deal with directly. I think, by and large, there's much higher levels of compliance, and I think we would pass the test. But once you go beyond the finance family, it becomes much tougher and really does involve many departments and better ways of getting that coordination. But let the colleagues from the FIC respond. I just want to make the point, and before they come in, they cannot tell us, Honorable Abram, for example, much on SJRs. They can't tell the Treasury. So even we generally, I mean, not generally, we don't ever see SJRs. In fact, I only remember one SJR that was ever leaked, or two rather, that came in the papers, one involving SARS, one involving the ANC contest, leadership contest. But beyond those, you don't see anything. So it's just what's out in the public domain that someone has leaked, and it's illegal to leak and to alert. So I think the colleagues from the FIC can't really tell us, and they don't tell anybody from what I know. So people can be assured in that respect. But to the extent that anyone has broken the law and alerting, I don't think that by just closing an account, and we dealt with this when we dealt with the Financial Sector Regulation Act, that you know, we want people to have the right to banking and not be excluded, and especially poor customers. And the way banks close accounts, we introduced some basic standards, which now the FSCA has some powers. But by and large, it is very difficult to get in between any contractual relationship between bank and customer. And it's actually illegal. We don't have the power beyond what the regulation may be put. So if one company decides to terminate services, well, it's contractual law, and I wouldn't imagine that by itself would be breaking the law, but let the FIC answer that. Just the last point I would like to make is that, you know, criminals are very clever, and they know how and where the weaknesses in the system is, and how to go around us, and how to use the cash economy. So it becomes very difficult for us to actually make sure that our focus is in the right place. But we definitely need a more agile criminal prosecution system. But let me say that beyond the prosecution system, there's a lot of administrative powers we do have, which I don't believe we've used enough. to recover funds and so on. But at the end of the day, when it comes to the major issues, I mean, the FIC can come and they work with, I mean, most money laundering you pick up through the banking system. And so they have this institution called SAMBIT and so on to try and counter that. But I think, as was said by the director of FINIAS, the challenge is once they have the intelligence and they've conveyed it to the right authorities, what happens with that? Is there action? That's often the big issue that we need to take into account. Just on the mutual evaluation process, I think it was Honorable Abrams who asked, and apologies for the late presentation. Let me personally take responsibility. I know the colleagues in FIC had submitted something, and we submitted the same thing, but we just tried to make it easier, but apologies. It is our fault. The second point is, though the FATF process, and we can deal with the May-April dates, but we knew in 2018 we're going to get a mutual evaluation, and obviously there's some communication with the country. And in April 2019, they formally commenced the process. They did a lot of the work through lots of virtual link-ups, but they paid a site visit. If I remember, colleague, it was November or December 2020. And the problem was then in the follow-up, the way FATF works is that it has these massive plenaries. And with COVID, that came to a stop, and they weren't looking at mutual evaluation, so it was more the end of the process where there were some delays, and not just for South Africa, for many countries, and that, I guess, took long. But maybe the director and Peter Smith can come in. But let me stop there for now. They can answer some of the other questions that are coming at the end if there's any still outstanding.
Thank you, Momo, and thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll first, I think Momo has covered most of the responses that we wanted to cover, but we just add to Dr. George the issue of knowing your client and even very full, the identity of your client is very critical. It's critical for the banks to have that single client view, so that they can be able, if they know their client, they know where the source of income is coming from, the kind of business the client is involved in, whether alone or with other people, then they'll be able to monitor activities that are outside of the norm, activities that are unusual and suspicious, and report them to us. So if they don't know the client, they won't be able to even know that this is not really fitting the profile of the client that we know. They won't be able to report to us, and we will just close shop. But it is you are very much right. We need now to move from the rule-based approach that Momo is referring to and really focus on the risk-based approach and deal with critical matters. And this report is saying exactly that. On the issue of Honorable Mahada, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, apologies if I'm not. I'm hoping that with the National Anti-Corruption Strategy that has been adopted, I think, a year ago by Cabinet, we'll be able to address a number of deficiencies when it comes to our fight against corruption. There are a lot of activities happening in the ECCT, in the Fusion Center. Momo is mentioning the summit. But this strategy will be able to really assist us in addressing issues of beneficial ownership, in addressing issues of whistleblowers, and in coming up with a framework to say what kind of a framework really will assist. Do we really need one body, or what is it that we need from the multiple bodies that we are having that are mandated to fight corruption in order to be able to be successful and fight it effectively? On the issue of that was raised by Honorable Abraham on the delays, there were no delays, as Momo is saying. We had
an on-site visit. The FATF assessors were here in the country. They met everyone. There was no rush. The problem was when it came to the discussion of our report, the plenary meeting of FATF to discuss our report. We had never in the history of FATF had a hybrid model where our report is discussed and we are not in Paris. We are a Paris-based organization. So we had to say to FATF, we are not ready until FATF comes up with the rules on how to run a virtual plenary, so that we don't feel really that the process has been compromised because we're not there. So when those rules were finalized, then we were able to say we are ready, we are available, and our report was discussed, and we were happy with the process, and the report really speaks to things that we know that they exist in our country's challenges. When it comes to the issue of the Zondo Commission, are we working with the Zondo Commission, or have we worked with the Zondo Commission? We have worked with the Zondo Commission, and we have shared a lot of information with the Commission. Momo has really protected me. Thanks, Momo. I'm not really allowed to sit in front of you and say, have I looked at this case? Have I not looked at this case? But I know that there was a matter that went to the High Court that dealt with this matter. And if you look at that matter, it will tell you that the FIC really was involved. Let me say again, the FIC in the criminal value chain were part of the GCPS cluster, were part of the ACCT. Our role is very, very critical. We want to support all law enforcement agencies by ensuring that when they deal with critical or high impact cases, they have the benefits of our intelligence products. And we've gone very far, especially with the offices of Asset Forfeiture Unit, to say, even though we'll give you a product, but we'll try with the lawyers that we are having to even give you an affidavit so that your processes can move quicker. So we were involved in all the high impact cases that the colleagues bring to us, and in most of the cases, it's cases that they don't bring to us, but it's cases that we see ourselves and we produce a report and say, here is the report to move. The assessment hasn't found any serious issues about the FIC. In fact, we commended and FATF said, if we were assessing the FIC only, we wouldn't really be sitting and having a long, long debate because we are happy with what the FIC is producing. The problem that the assessors were not really happy with is that we produce an intelligence report, we share it with law enforcement agencies, and in the majority of the cases, such reports are not being utilized. And I don't blame really the law enforcement agencies because they are, if you look at the report, it will tell you the capacity of the ops at the time of the on-site. What was the capacity figures? They were less than 50% of their capacity. They were 3,000. So they had 3,500 vacancies. So if you see such vacancies, instead of really prioritizing what the FIC is bringing to you, you prioritize what is already registered in a case or case that is in front of you. The prosecution, I don't know how long was the prosecution complaining about resources. They were just assisted with the resources recently. And I don't even think those resources are sufficient. When at the time I was in the NPA, we were talking about two prosecutors' reports. You can ask the NPP whether she does have two prosecutors' reports. I'm not sure. So when you deal with highly numbering cases, the number of entities involved has the criminals who are very much organized. So it's very important that we ensure that we have a dedicated pool that is sufficiently capacitated and has all the right skills to be able to deal with such cases. But those are the things that will be addressed with by our strategy. On the issue of the Inspector General, the spaza shops, and the issues of Honorable Sposani, I will ask my colleague Peter to really respond to them, and then other questions will be taken by Phineas and Christopher.
Thank you, Director. So I think on the question of the FIC, whether we fall under the jurisdiction of the Inspector General for Intelligence or not, it is important, firstly, to keep in mind that the FIC although we produce what we call financial intelligence, information, in other words, that we supply for investigative purposes, the FIC is in fact not an intelligence agency. And if one looks at the definitions in the legislation that regulates intelligence activities, the FIC doesn't perform those activities. We don't, for instance, do, operate covertly. We're not allowed to send people undercover to observe financial activity. We're not allowed to collect any intelligence ourselves. All that we receive is what is reported to us through legal obligations on financial institutions to report suspicious transactions, et cetera, et cetera. And otherwise, we have access to generally available information that is held in the public service in for instance, the Department of Home Affairs, subsidiary courts and companies, et cetera, et cetera. So it's important to keep in mind that the FIC is not actually an intelligence gathering agency. We had a discussion actually with the Inspector General a few times in the past, specifically on this issue, to test whether we and the Inspector General see things the same way and have the same interpretation. And the conclusions of those discussions were that the FIC is in fact not an intelligence agency, and that the Inspector General also does not see the need for them to exercise oversight over the activities of the FIC. That is not to say that the FIC is not accountable to anybody. And I think it's important. Firstly, we are obviously accountable to the Minister of Finance, who's our executive authority. But the FIC also accounts on a regular basis to yourselves, the Standing Committee on Finance. When we are called and invited, in the past we have done so, to present our annual reports, our performance information, our budget information, basically everything that we can report publicly on our operations. But on occasion, the FIC has also been called to Parliament by the Standing Committee on Intelligence to account for the way in which the FIC conducts its operations. And this is specifically to ensure that the FIC doesn't overstep its boundaries and sort of color outside the lines of what is clearly provided for in our legislation. We can rely entirely on the partners that we work with around us, in especially in the law enforcement agencies, the Crime Intelligence Agency, as also a unit in the SAPS, and so on, for the criminal intelligence work that needs to complement the FIC's work. So I hope that it's a good clarification. I just wanted to pick up on also the question on the closure of the OPA and Gupta accounts and whether that was tipping off, and the consequences that the closure of those accounts had, for instance, for us and the work that the FIC does. The view that we looked very carefully at this at the time, in the discussions that became clear to us in the follow-up with the banks that made the decisions to close, it was clear that those decisions of the banks were not communicated in a way to the customers, OPA company and its various affiliates and the Gupta family, by disclosing the fact that the various banks had reported anything to the FIC. If they had done that, that would have been tipping off. If they told the customer that, listen, I've reported your business to the FIC, I can no longer do business with you, therefore I'm closing this account. That would have been tipping off. But that was in fact not what happened. In the cases, most of the banks, what they told us was that they did not feel they could adequately continue managing the risks that the bank itself may become involved in criminal activity by its association with the account holders. And therefore, the banks decided to step away. We, in no unclear terms, actually told the banks that we don't appreciate the process of them closing accounts for customers, because that comes to the next point on our ability to freeze funds. We cannot freeze funds once an account is closed and the money has been taken out of that account. And that is in fact what happened in this case with the large amounts of money that left the country before we could get control of those funds, put in place the freezing orders that the FIC can do and allow our processes, for instance, the asset forfeiture applications to take over that, to bring the right applications in court and to freeze the funds and bring forfeiture applications and so on. We believe it was actually a premature step that in, took away that option for us to step in and take control of the funds when the opportunity was there. So this is, in fact, not a behavior that the FIC encourages, and quite to the contrary. We actually are very clear when we speak to banks that we do not accept a bank's explanation very easily that it's the last resort, that they cannot keep an account for an account holder, because it jeopardizes the FIC's own work as well. I think that also touches on what Momo mentioned earlier and the questions from Honorable George and from the chairperson. With the current legislation that's now in place, the institutions such as the bank must assess the risk and they must apply a risk-based approach. So they are not allowed to treat all customers the same. They must differentiate which customers are low risk, that they can allow to continue with their business more freely with less questions asked. They need to know some information because they can't deal with anonymous customers, but then can focus on the high-risk customers, which in this case the bank should have done. In the way that we've been discussing this, especially with our colleagues in the Prudential Authority and the other supervisors, also to make carry the message across to them that when they inspect banks, they must expect the bank to apply a risk-based approach. And if a bank doesn't, then the bank is in fact not complying with its legal obligations. But as we know, behavior changes slowly. Banks haven't quite adapted to this process of implementation yet, especially for customers that they've had on their books for years now. The incentives to change, I think, needs to come from the pressure that the supervisors place on those institutions. There was one question. I think that also links to the question of the spaza shops, because again, in the promotion of financial inclusion, that is a key and stated government policy that is driven by the National Treasury. The FIC by no means should get in the way of the implementation of that policy. In fact, it's in our benefit as the FIC to have more people within the banking system, as I explained just now. So there are many reasons why people operate still in a cash economy. For instance, with spaza shops, if the customers of the spaza shop only deal in cash, then the spaza shop doesn't have a need for a bank account because it's going to receive cash from its customers and vice versa. So it becomes sort of a mutually reinforcing problem. That those are really key policy questions that South Africa still needs to grapple with. And from our point of view, we want to make the legislation as a worker in a way that allows a broader range of people to have access to financial institutions where they are within a regulated environment, where we can expect banks to have some information on those customers, where we can expect to engage with those when they deal with criminal elements, that they can pick up on that and report to us as well. I think those are basically all the questions I wanted to deal with. Thank you.
Can you hand over? Chair, with your permission, can I ask Mr. Malan, Christopher Malan, to charge on the issue of the state forensic capability project?
Morning, Chairperson, honourable members, colleagues. The issue of the capacity of the state in the area of forensic capability is one that is currently a working project in the ACTT. I have the privilege of being asked to lead that working group, and we are pleased to inform the members that the report is being finalized. It will be sent to the Secretariat soon, and it will be heard on the 23rd of February by the principals. The underlying issue is really that in order to have effective investigation and prosecutions, the evidentiary leg is critical. And what we find is, notwithstanding the best intentions and efforts of our investigators, the matters that are of the highest concern in the state capture area involved highly complex issues, complex structures, companies and a level of complexity that needs an evidentiary response that matches it. And the issue is that due to a lack of serious forensic capability, you find that investigations tend to drag on. And furthermore, that if the evidence is not gathered appropriately, the prosecutors cannot proceed into the prosecution leg of a matter. And most importantly, the assets. We cannot identify the assets to pursue asset recovery. The nub of the issue is that the forensic capability in the state within the ACTT is very low. It is in a nascent state. There are low numbers of people that are skilled in forensics in each and every one of the ACTT partners. The upshot of the issue is we are proposing that there be a state forensic capability be established and endorsed and funded that would look at the high-end matters, impactful matters, mainly related to state capture, to provide the very important transmission mechanisms from information gathering and the conversion of that into forensic evidence so that we could truncate and shorten the time taken to investigate properly, and to ensure the evidence is there to enable the prosecution leg to commence, and once commenced, to commence with all the forensic evidence available utilizing the specialist capability. One last point is that in the forensic cycle, what we tend to find currently is that the state is expending within the ACT partnership a large amount of money on private sector forensic capability because just of the nature of the extent of work needed. And because the state doesn't have the capacity itself, we find that in one big matter, there could be three or four forensic instructions underway. It's not been coordinated nor managed. You then have these forensic outcomes being put on the table as completed products, but they don't talk to each other, they're not integrated, they do not carry forward a holistic theme to prosecute successfully. So we hope that with this proposal, we'll be able to establish some capacity within the ACTT, and the purpose of this capacity is to service the ACTT partners to deal with high-impact particular matters, essentially in the area of state capture and corruption. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, Mr. Miloto will deal with the laws that require amendments as well as the composition of the interdepartmental working group. That's the last question, Chair. We have covered everything. Genius?
Okay. Thank you. Chair, the honourable members for the questions. Maybe before I deal with these two ones, just wanted to address question which was raised in relation to whether or not the identification requirements in the FIC Act pose challenges for ordinary citizens. And I think here we need to look at two pieces, and I'll give a practical example. So if you walk into a bank, then you give them your smart ID or the green ID, and then they have your fingerprint that they can verify with Home Affairs. So they would know that the person standing before them is who they say that person says they are. So it's okay there. Now the challenge becomes when now you want to not identify but verify the identity of a legal person, which is a company or a legal arrangement would be a trust. So in that case, then the person opening the account will then provide all the documentation that they would have received from a competent authority. If it's a company, that will be coming from the CIPC, and then of course, if it's a trust, then it will be coming from the master of the High Court. Now, what then would they use to verify the documents that are presented before them? This is the challenge we spoke about in relation to beneficial ownership, because at the moment, the Companies Act as well as the Trust Control Property Act do not specifically or explicitly require that information on beneficial owners, the warm bodies that actually own and control the company, that information needs to be provided to the SIPs or the mothers. And secondly, as a consequence, then there is no database similar to oversimplify the one that Home Affairs would have on citizens from which then verification can be made. As a result of that, then you are left to rely on self-declarations. And the chances are that where someone creates an enterprise which is solely created for nefarious activities, then the likelihood of disguising the true identity as well as the intended purpose when they enter into that relationship with the bank is very high, and depending on the systems that you have. So that is where the challenge is. And you've seen this, the number of typologies in the country where companies have actually been abused for this firm. Some actually set themselves up for purposes of rampaging through, the government institutions, state-owned enterprises, and we saw in the private sector as well, Steinhoff, BPS. If you look at all those, the challenge now for the banks as well as the law enforcement agencies, whether or not they know who are the people behind this transaction, these structures that have been created. So that is the challenge that we've been emphasizing that we need to quickly attend to. Now, let me now move to the issue of the laws. I'm just going to move quickly. I'm not going to say what in those laws needs to be dealt with, if you allow me, unless you want specific details which you can provide. The law that needs to be amended would be the POCDATARA Act, our terrorist financing law, in which we then transfer the obligations on the United Nations to the resolution into the Financial Intelligence Center Act, because currently it has to be done through a proclamation, and it's also been done by the Police Civil Secretariat, and it has not been, the list that comes from the UN has not been updated since 2017, since the last assessment. So that is the challenge. And within the FIC, there is already a capability of similar structure in terms of proliferation financing, which is deemed to be working very effectively. So that's it. Then second one is the Financial Intelligence Center Act itself, which is the primary legislation that set out the regulatory obligations for the financial institutions and other related sectors to comply with. In this case, we need firstly to expand the scope of the activities that the FATF requires us to cover. At the moment, there is a deficiency in that case. And then we need also to strengthen some of the requirements, including enhanced due diligence measures in them. Then there is the Companies Act, which will now provide for a legal obligation, for people that are establishing companies to provide beneficial ownership information, for the CIPC to verify that information, have a database that will be accessible by law enforcement agencies and financial institutions to have access to that information. A similar structure would then need to be set up within the Master of the High Court in terms of amendments to the Trust Control Property Act that deals with trust. And then, of course, the NPO Act, which currently does not explicitly provide for the requirements to register, and then, of course, or rather, enforceable requirements are that if you don't comply with the obligation, then you will be sanctioned. So the penalty clause needs to be strengthened in that regard. So I'm not sure if there is anything else that I left in terms of the laws. But lastly, in terms of the composition, I'll just run them quickly of the working group that worked together. So for law enforcement agencies, we've got the SIU, we've got the NPA, family, your asset forfeiture, and so on. And then you've got SARS, you've got DHA, you've got the SAPS family, where you have your DPCI and the others. And then in terms of the ministries, you've got DECO, and then you've got Justice. And then, of course, you've got SSA, and then you've got NICOG also as a member. Then you've got the supervisory bodies, you've got the South African Reserve Bank family, the Prudential Authority, FinCEF, NPSD, they're all part of that. The Financial Sector Conduct Authority, popularly known as or abbreviated as FISCA, and then the FIC itself, and then the Estate Agency Affairs Board that regulates estate agents, and then for the Legal Practice Council, which is practitioners council which deals with lawyers, and then for the provincial licensing authorities in respect of casinos. So in all the 9 provinces, they are members of this, and then for the of course, SIPS itself, we've got the Master of the High Court, because the National Treasury in that setup. So it's a multi-agency setup which really fits into the work that the IDC does. So, and that's how we are structured currently. I'm not sure if I left anything out, but I think these were the main questions that were asked in relation to the composition. Thank you very much for the question.
Honourable Chair, I think from our side, you have finalised all the questions, and thank you for your time.
Okay. Chair, if I may just come in then to conclude, I think just wanted to make just one or two points. I think the big issue of, on the one hand, having these controls for the anti-money laundering system and its impact on financial inclusion is always a big issue for us to get the right balance and to explain that. We have, in fact, published last year, Chair, a policy paper on financial inclusion to take comments, which we'll be finalizing, but the committee may be interested in going through it, because I think there's important issues that get raised. And in fact, one of the big issues, as I said earlier, is that we want to make sure that most people in some sense have access to basic banking accounts. If you don't have a banking account, it's a problem. It does raise difficult issues, like the question that was raised on spaza shops for someone who doesn't have, say, all the particular documentation. If the system doesn't allow them to get bank accounts, then they are outside it, and as Advocate Smith was saying, that we prefer people to have bank accounts rather than be outside the system, because then, honestly, all kinds of, there's more scope, we think, of behavior that may be illegal and so on. So you want to formalize people into the system, and that's quite a big objective from a financial inclusion perspective. That said, I think that when you look at the issue of bank closures, and certainly when it came to the Oak Bay or the Gupta story, it's like a chicken and egg. I think some banks were frustrated that no action was being taken by government because of years of SDRs. That's a sense I get. Or did some of them, my question is, why did they not even close their bank accounts then earlier in some instance? It may point to the failure of specific authorities to act. And in a sense, that's why we await for what the Zondo Commission will say on that. I think it will be very useful to see how it concludes and deals with it. Just on the issue of the Inspector General, I think that's, for me, it's a good question. There's always scope for abuse, whether it's FIC, it's Treasury, of course, whether it's SARS. But particularly when it comes to SARS, the Nugent Commission's proposal on the Inspector General is something that we will be bringing to Parliament. And I think, we could also look at that model so that if there are abuses, how do you deal with it? Even though I think what Edward Smith was saying, importantly, the FIC is not an intelligence agency, despite the I in its name. And I think he outlined just what they don't do and what limited powers they have. But we accept that there is scope for abuse if confidential information gets leaked out. And we need to just make sure that we have a system that's fair to everybody, and to the extent that there's weaknesses in the system, how you deal with it. And I think the important question is, yes, those who in the past have abused confidentiality, to the extent that we can find them, we hope that they do be held criminally liable for doing what they did when they broke the law. Chair, I think that kind of concludes, even on our side, all the points that I think the questions that were asked. And over to you, Chair.
Okay, thanks. There's a follow-up question from Honorable Kosan Mhlonishwa.
Now, Ngiyathokoza Sihlalo. I can see that all questions have been answered except mine. My question was, since the cabinet established an interdepartmental committee in 2018, which is led by the DG of the National Treasury, are there any good stories to tell comparatively if we compare the period from 2018 to date with the period prior to the establishment of that committee in 2018? Are there any good stories to tell? Are there things that we can pinpoint to say, yes, since we have established this interdepartmental committee, indeed, we have moved, we are able to crack these cases, we are able to achieve this and that and that. That was my question, Chenga Togos.
Togos, I'm showing you. Are we able to get the report of the IGC director and Momo?
Momo, question.
Speaking on what this concern is.
Let me come in, Chair. Chair, I think some of the reports, I think, may be sensitive, so we need to check that. I mean, minutes are taken of the meeting. But let me, I think the question that Honorable Kosana asked, I think is a good question. And we certainly don't want to come here and say we've been a roaring success and everything's working. There are really hard challenges. And part of it, as we've said, is the committee can coordinate and make and try and push each one to do what they're doing and ultimately report them to their responsible ministers to the extent that it's not, it's happening or not happening. In terms of when the committee was established, the first phase, in a sense, was to get over the mutual evaluation. And I think there was a lot of cooperation from all the institutions. They were very open, provided all the information and so on. I think the challenge that we face is whilst there's a lot of commitment to act, and yes, on one hand, we do need to produce certain plans and finalize them, is the extent to which they are implemented. And here too, we do have problems. So, you know, for example, the criminal justice authorities don't report to the DG of Treasury, and there are specific provisions on how they act and so on. So, you know, there's a lot of scope for saying this bit works and the other bit doesn't work. But I would say that the next 6 months is going to be critical for that committee to oversee the plan and find a way that though everybody is accountable to a different political principle that, and ultimately to cabinet, that we actually succeed as a country. So there are challenges, but and the working team is meeting. We're now meeting every week to try and develop the plan. And there's lots of meetings, but I think how that will conclude is a challenge that we face. So I don't want to say that there's a roaring success yet. It's work in progress. And we can find a way to report to the committee chair. But the issues have largely been one of coordination up to now.
Okay, thanks. Alan and Tebuho, can you write to IDC to come and appear before this committee at some stage in the next quarter so that we understand what they're doing? FIC will also be invited to be part of that meeting with Treasury because what they're doing is linked to what the report that we have received today. So let's meet the IDC. It is up to them to edit the report, what is relevant for public consumption, and if ever there is sensitive information, they will expunge that from the report. But we want to understand, because there are bodies which are not here, like the NPA. What you are saying today is that you feel frustrated by the NPA, for instance. You have got evidence, you have got issues that have to be taken to court. But there does not seem to be capacity from that level, the works and CIPC is responsible for registering companies, but it looks like there are loopholes. So probably if the IDC comes here, because it's more multidisciplinary, they will be able to report as to how do they deal with those issues which are outside your ambit. But that as it may, thanks very much for this comprehensive report. It enables us to do our work in terms of oversight and then report back to Parliament as to what is happening in this regard, because money laundering is a serious problem in South Africa. The revenue collection is quite very low as we speak because of this challenge. As you have correctly said, the problem now is the cash economy. There's a lot of cash going around without being accounted to. How do we deal with that? So we believe that also in that IDC meeting, SARS will be there to deal with some of the issues and the prudential authority. Thanks very much, honorable members, FIC team, Treasury, PBO, SCOF team from the administrative side, and other officials from Parliament, media, the public. Thanks very much. Tebogo, I've seen your email and the WhatsApp that you sent to me, that there seemed to be a challenge in regard to tomorrow's meeting, that it looks like NEDLAC is not available. What was the story?
They are saying that there are internal processes that they were supposed to have made that they were not able to. And the main thing is that they haven't been able to hold the summit as proposed in 2019. Committee. So they said they send a text in everything. And that I mean that every summit is and soon and means to.
I can't pretend to that I've understood what you're saying. I just heard a summit, something. Can you repeat what is the reason why they are not coming? You seem to have a serious problem with the network. Can you move around and explain to us why they are not coming and what do you suggest we should do? Because they should come and appear before this committee. There seems to be a problem of connectivity from the side of Tebogo. Tebogo, can you hear me? Okay. We'll deal with that after this meeting.
It looks like tomorrow, sir, we'll only get... Yes, I can hear you now, sir. It looks like tomorrow we'll only receive... We'll have to be briefed by the BEE Commission only.
Where are you? Are you in South Rainek where there's a problem of connectivity? Or...
I'm in Cape Town, say, but I don't know. Just always says my bandwidth is low. Sometimes it's okay. So I don't know what to do anymore.
Okay. Do you have a Wi-Fi where you stay or in your office? Because you have to do something about.
No, I use my phone. Yes, I am, sir. But in the meantime, I'm using my phone as a hotspot.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Thanks very much, honorable members. The meeting is adjourned. We'll meet again.